Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Praxis Audit Audio Conference in support of audit projects around the country. My name is Denise Ng. I'm the Praxis Safety and Accountability Audit Program Manager, and I'm joined on the line today by Lucy Pope, who's our Praxis Technical Assistance Partner and who will facilitate today's call. As you know, our topic today is conducting safety audits in rural communities. We are very pleased to have with us three people from around the country who have participated in this kind of analysis of their communities in rural areas around the country. Melissa Skaya is Executive Director of Advocates for Family Peace in Grand Rapids, where the community is about to begin your fourth audit. Is that right, Melissa?
Right.
And Jennifer Maley is from Medford, Oregon, another jurisdiction that's kind of caught the audit bug, and they've done, I think, four audits as well. And, Jen, I believe you've been audit coordinator every time you've done an audit. Is that right?
We have done seven audits.
Oh, my gosh. And you've been the audit coordinator each time.
Yes.
Wow, very extensive experience, so I know you'll really like hearing from Jen. And finally, Pam Wiener is from Legal Aid of Western Ohio, and Pam is with us as well. Pam was involved in the Ohio custody audit and was audit coordinator for that audit. And if you tune in a couple of weeks on December 1st, we're going to have a pretty extensive call specifically about that audit. And so I just want to welcome all of you and thank you in advance for taking your time to be with us today and to share your insights. In just a moment, Lucy is going to lead our guests in a discussion about today's topic. During most of the call, participant lines will be muted just in order to minimize background noise, but will be open periodically so that you can ask some questions. So, Stephanie, can you tell us how participants can indicate that they have a question or comment?
To join the question queue, you would simply press the number 1 on your touchtone phone.
Okay, so if when the lines are open, you can press 1 on your touchtone phone to get in the question queue, and Stephanie will indicate to us that there's a call waiting. And when you ask a question or comment, do try to remember to say your name and the state you're calling from, because with several callers on the line, voice recognition can be difficult. And alternatively, if you have a question or a comment and you don't want to ask it audibly, you can certainly email a question to me at denise@praxisinternational.org, and when we pause for participant questions and comments, I'll make sure that your question or comment is heard. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lucy, who'll get us started on today's call.
Welcome. Thank you all for joining us. Well, we have three guests on our call today representing different experiences with safety audits in rural communities. Pam Heyman-Wiener serves 23 rural counties in the western part of Ohio. She's been an attorney with Legal Aid of Western Ohio for 19 years and is now their regional domestic violence coordinator. She also coordinates the activities of the Family Justice Center of Northwest Ohio, and that program serves six counties and a migrant rest center. One of these counties, Henry County, is a rural agricultural area of about 29,000 people. Over the last year, Henry County was the site of the national demonstration audit on child custody and domestic relations court. Pam has been their audit coordinator, and they're just finishing up the final draft of their report. Jennifer Miley has coordinated, as we said, seven safety audits for the Jackson County Council Against Domestic and Sexual Violence in Medford, Oregon. In the mountains of southwestern Oregon, Jackson County has a population of about 200,000 spread over 2,800 square miles. Their audit team has looked at prosecution, police, dispatch, shelter intake, and helpline advocacy. Their most recent audits are of child welfare and self-sufficiency. For those interested, two of their audit reports are available on the Praxis website. Jen comes from a multidisciplinary background, has been a juvenile court probation officer, victim witness advocate, and is a freelance audit coordinator. Melissa Skaya is the Executive Director of Advocates for Family Peace, a six-program agency that provides domestic violence and child abuse services throughout Itasca County in north-central Minnesota. This is the third largest county in the state and has a population of about 43,000. Melissa has coordinated five audits: dispatch, law enforcement, prosecution, probation, and advocacy. She provides training and technical assistance as a consultant for Praxis and serves as a faculty member for the Family Violence Department at the National Council on Juvenile and Family Court Judges. She's written extensively on the effects of domestic violence on children, supervised visitation, and batterers intervention programs. So we have lots of different experiences with different kinds of rural. We've asked these presenters to have a conversation about the characteristics of rural communities that strengthen or challenge the safety audit process. And as we talked, we came up with characteristics that were common to all three of our guests, and we'll focus on those today. Confidentiality, limited staff in system offices, and practitioners with close personal relationships. So let's start with confidentiality. Any of us who work on violence against women in rural areas know confidentiality is an issue. In terms of the safety audit, when the audit team of practitioners come together and they look at those case files and talk about system practices, confidentiality can present some challenges. So, Jen, can you get us started and speak to how confidentiality presented itself in the Jackson County audits and how you handled that as an audit coordinator? And I certainly invite the other presenters to jump in and add and flesh out your experience also. Thank you, Jen.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me today. So our audits here in Jackson County, being in a different kind of rural than some of your very, very large counties, have been interesting in that the confidentiality pieces have boiled down to the team knowing the people involved in the cases that we're auditing, reading prosecution reports, hearing dispatch tapes, looking at child welfare cases, that we know the people involved. We know their children, we know them, we know the perpetrator or the victim, and that level of confidentiality then requires some finesse within the audit team to really have people be able to keep the personal things they know about the families separate from what's happening in the audit. But then as an audit coordinator, also creating then the space for them to be able to come to me and talk about those things so that they can keep them separate. That's been an interesting piece that's come up over and over for us. We have a very small community, so people have thoughts and judgments about people that can then impact the audit process. And the other part of that is that the practitioners themselves are often part of the audit. They either know the practitioner, are married to the other practitioners, or are them themselves. And that's an interesting thing to walk through when you're, for instance, looking at a prosecution audit and there's one prosecutor and he's on the team. It's been an interesting road because you have to keep the politics at one level and then really delve into the practices at another level. I don't know much more about what you want me to in a direction, Lucy.
And what when you say that you keep the politics kind of separate from the practices that you're looking at, how do you do that? Do you do that with an agenda? Do you do that with training? I mean, Melissa and Pam, you might have some ideas about this too, but
for us, what we started out with was just laying all the cards out on the table and being really clear that these things could be challenges. And people came in with their professional hats on, you know, that they do this already in their job. They know their clients sometimes. Their neighbor comes in for services, or they've, you know, arrested your brother-in-law or something like that. So people came in with wearing some of those hats already, but we just put the cards out on the table and said, okay, so you're going to see people's names that you know, or your name is going to be in here, and here's what we're going to do about that. If it becomes difficult for you, here's what we're going to do. You can talk to Jennifer on the side. We can put this case on hold while we figure out some of the messiness. If there's cases that are really difficult in terms of not wanting to expose the family members involved, then we could let me know, and then we would pull that case out and not use it.
Did any of the three of you do redacting? where you would cross out the name so that people didn't know? Or in a rural community, does that matter?
We tried it in our process, Jennifer. We tried it in our prosecution audit. We started out that way. But honestly, the specifics of the cases really made the redacting not valuable to us.
But people knew the stories.
They did. They knew the story. They knew, you know, what part of town. They knew from all kinds of different little details what was going on anyway.
Yeah, and I think this is Pam Weiner, and I think that was our experience, too, is that even if you were to present things as a hypothetical, everybody knew exactly who you were talking about. And most of the people on the audit team were the one and only person who handles domestic violence case in a particular arena, and so many of us had worked on most of the cases that were being audited. And I think one of the challenges with that for us in the small community is when it is the same people working on the cases and they know who the people are and their families are and the perpetrators are, that oftentimes the files are very insufficient with information, because things happen so informally among the different agency people because they know each other so well. And so one of the challenges is not to try to fill in the gaps when the records were not complete with information, to be able to evaluate what was going on. And I think that was one of the important outcomes that we came, was how important it is to make sure that information does get in the case files, because the same people aren't always going to be the ones who are handling the case, and what happens now could impact major decisions 10 years or 15 years down the road with the same families. I think the other piece that came out of the audit team people knowing most of the details of the cases we were working on is that there was some trauma associated in the process for some of our audit team. We had some audit team members who were survivors, and so for the survivors, it had a different trauma piece to it. And for the people who were working with those families, reading these files over and over again was reliving the family's experiences. And so we really also had to take care of each other and be able to keep that in perspective and have people step out when it was too emotionally draining.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the other thing I'm wondering, in my small community, sometimes because practitioners have seen the same couple maybe for many times, many arrests, many years, they form some judgments around those folks and some stereotypes and some thoughts, and they don't have trouble sharing those with other practitioners. So I'm wondering if the audit process helped to kind of, what you did to help squelch that, or how did you respond? Did that ever come up where there was judgments?
This is Melissa. Can I just, I'll comment about that, but I do want to say the thing about redacting, because for us and our memorandum of understanding for our, we did our audits to the Grants to Encourage Arrest grants, the Office of Violence Against Women. And for us, we made a commitment very early on that we would redact all the files. So we became the kings and queens of redacting. I mean, there was like a small, we had like redacting parties, because It took a really long time, but we're a sort of medium-sized rural community, so we did have enough, we have three prosecutors, so in our county level, so we did have enough where we didn't necessarily know who it was. And we also committed to redacting files at various time frames. So, for example, we redact a file that was from one from 5 years ago, one from 3 years ago, four from the last 6 months, and, eight from the last 2 months or something. I don't remember the exact time frames were. But so some of them had left our memories in part. We really worked really hard to take out all the identifying information. Now, in hindsight, just hearing this conversation, it makes me think, oh, geez, that was a whole lot of work. And I think about all the, all the headaches we got from all the black markers that we used. But I think about, we made a commitment to it before we did our audit. And so because of that, we agreed to it. And because we started that with our first audit, we had to commit to it for the rest of them because we didn't want to change the dynamics of the conversations that happened. But there was a level of judgment. I mean, there were, of course, a few where we all knew who it was, and because one was a really big case that actually went to trial.
Yeah.
And we don't get that many that go to trial. So, of course, we all knew, you know, which one that was.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of judgment. But we also conducted focus groups of battered women. And some of those women, when we did our advocacy audit, that was really, really important to us, is that we would not audit our advocacy program unless we had a written release from the women. And part of the written release also did say that we would redact their file. So if you audit your advocacy program, I want to say, and I don't know if others have, but when you audit your advocacy program, the level of confidential that we wanted to commit to wanted to be pretty high, as opposed to when we, you know, we took the county attorney's files, for example. It was a bit of a different experience because of what they had in their files about women was very different.
Yes.
Than in an advocacy program.
Absolutely. Do you think that redacting then made a difference in the buy-in that we were talking about a little, mentioned a little bit earlier? Did that help agencies participate, or did it really matter?
I don't know that it really mattered. We were just very committed to keeping a same and similar process.
I see. Any other thoughts about confidentiality, Jen or Pam?
Well, I just kind of piggybacking on what you had said with judgments and drawing conclusions based on information that you have from your community knowledge of people and families. I think one of the big lessons we learned through the safety audit also is how many decisions victims make as a result of the way systems play themselves out, and that a lot of it takes away victim autonomy and choices, and we force victim into choices to make the system more efficient or because it's just the way we do things, and then we make value judgments of the choices victims make because of a system we set up that's not really functional for their choice, for their success or safety or long-term stability. And I think that was a really eye-opening for us and painful.
Do you have an example?
One of the examples that we have is when actually one of them is the lack of domestic violence screening as people go through the process. But one of the systems that was set in place is when a victim applies for public assistance, depending on the type of assistance they're getting, the case will go to child support. And once it goes to child support, if there's an agreement on custody, then that agreement then will be reduced to writing and become an order of the court in the juvenile court. When there's not screening for domestic violence, victims may be coerced into making decisions that are not in their best interest or safety or the safety of the children. And if they're not in agreement, then to try to make things easier for pro se litigants, it would be referred to mediation. And while there was a screening process, there were still many victims who were going into mediation feeling coerced or unsafe in saying what was safe for themselves and their children, consequently decisions being made and orders being made that didn't protect the safety of the families that weren't intentional, and had the information been before the judge so the judge could understand that background, the judge wouldn't have made those decisions. And so it's just those systems we put in place that appear to be well-intentioned, but then have detrimental effects for some people, especially victims of domestic violence.
And that follows all the way through the system.
Absolutely. And we've already changed a lot of practices even before our report is out as a result of some of those things.
Right, right, right. So, all right, well, confidentiality,
One more thing, Lucy, if that's...
Sure.
The other thing that I wanted to say about confidentiality was along those lines of thinking about what's happening for survivors of domestic violence is that when we had the multidisciplinary groups, invariably people were learning things from the audit that they should not have known in their regular job about about survivors particularly or about their children. And in that sense, we really had to keep an eye on that process and to say, this information that you're getting here in the audit team is not information then that you can take back to your agency. For instance, if a probation officer learned something about a victim through the child welfare case, which happened quite often, then they can take that back to their probation department and tell the probation officer of that victim.
Wow.
That's the thing. So we've had quite a few conversations about that when, kind of like we were talking about, not when women don't have the choices because of how the system is set up, then the choices they do make are judged on them so harshly, and then making sure that they stayed confidential because these people did agree to have their files looked at. All the victims in the child welfare case particularly, they all signed agreements saying that they would allow their files to be read.
Wow.
And so within that, we had to really guarantee their confidentiality in the disciplinary team. And that was a challenge, and it brought us many, many conversations because people wanted to take action.
Right, right.
They read. We were reading current files, things that were happening right now, and it was a really good learning experience for everybody, and also a challenge because in a small community, there is that idea that, well, if we just talk to each other, we could fix it. And that's not the purpose of this, wasn't just each individual case. It was to look at it as a whole.
And it seems like there would be some issues raised then with if I'm a mandated reporter or if my policies say I have to do something, then and now I have access to this new information, that presents a dilemma.
It would. It did have, within our helpline, our 24/7 helpline audit that came up when people heard things that had to be reported. We instituted a process for that, and we talked to the Department of Human Services about, okay, what are we going to do? And we made an agreement with the police department about what do we do when that happens. What is our procedure going to be as an audit team, which is to notify the coordinator that you've heard this, and then together we make the report.
Well, would you recommend then that, of course, you can't predict all these things until you've probably been through it once or twice, but would you recommend that this is part of your introductory training process? Would you put these kind of rules about confidentiality into MOUs? Where is this appropriate to really start having these conversations before you find yourself in the middle of something?
For us, we do what has worked is to do a kind of generalized blanket, here's three ways in which confidentiality can be an issue, and then to keep it up. Never consider confidentiality a closed topic. Never consider yourself trained out of it. It's going to keep coming up and up and up, and there's, you know, it's a nice opportunity to work through it as a team. It does come up, and it really helped bring the team into a good working together.
Yeah.
To talk around these issues. And, I mean, to have some tough discussions is a great thing for an audit team. You don't want this to be an easy process. You want to challenge each other.
Okay. Thank you. That's great. Well, why don't we open this up to anyone who has questions who are listening in on this?
And we actually do have a guest in the queue at this time.
Okay.
And that would be the Rose Advocate. Your line is now open.
Great. Thank you. Your name and where you're from?
This is Cheryl Phillips. I'm from Weezer, Idaho. And my question is, did you, maybe I missed this, but did you have signed letters of confidentiality as a team? And did you go through that process of creating a confidentiality agreement at the beginning of your audits when you faced some of these issues?
Good question.
This is Melissa. As I kind of mentioned this before, but we did it when we did our grant, and then we re-signed it when we did our when we actually did our audit.
This is Pam with Legal Aid. We did it once we identified our local and our national team who were working together, and then had confidentiality agreements that the participants signed along with the coordinator and the judge.
Oh, okay.
Jennifer, we did the same thing. Once we'd identified the team, we used the practice for the confidentiality agreement for the audit team members, and we just used that one.
And those of you who did, I think Jen and Melissa, you both did advocacy audits. Did you then both get permission from the women? Was that a different, different than your, say, law enforcement or 911?
Yes, that was different for us.
Okay.
This is Jennifer. Yes, it was a different agreement that we had presented to individual women and focus groups and got their permission.
Thank you. Another community characteristic in rural areas is that practitioners work alone or have very small staffs. A prosecutor or probation officer may be the only person in the office and has to handle all the calls. So, Melissa, in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, your community is just over, under 8,000 folks?
No, we're 43,000.
In the county?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. But what are the challenges that an audit coordinator faces when participating systems have such a limited number of staff?
Well, the first challenge is getting them to commit to some very long audit meetings. That's the first challenge. Is figuring out how they're going to be there and not be interrupted.
Okay.
And so that's a really big challenge with people in terms of scheduling. And then it's sometimes it's a grumbling about that, you know, to get meetings scheduled. And so we're always sort of strategizing about, okay, is it better just to do it once and do it all day and then wait another long period of time, or should we do it in a short series of meetings? So scheduling is a real big challenge.
Okay.
When you have limited resources. The other thing, of course, that comes up is that there's part of the audit process is to look at the systemic response and how the worker is organized as opposed to looking at who the worker is.
Mm-hmm.
And so in rural communities, the options are very few. So when you start to look at a case, for example, and it's a really bad one in terms of the systemic response, it's not a whole lot of people who actually did it, you know, who are part of the options. And so it becomes easy to point that finger, and then people, it creates a dynamic of getting very defensive.
Mm.
And so it becomes a challenge in that way. And then we are also very, very committed to observing each other's work. And so I will say there's a great benefit in that people kind of really enjoyed having other people understand the work environment in which they worked in.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it, of course, is very labor-intensive. So we would schedule things for people to go and observe, and then, you know, something would come up, and then they couldn't do it. And
yeah.
So because they don't have any backup of any sort. So it becomes a problem of resources for communities in that way. And it's always, you know, with these grants, is also sometimes there's a dynamic. So for example, in our community, not every criminal justice agency gets money from the arrest grant, and so only a couple do. And so it's, oh, yeah, well, you can do this. You have the time for this because you get some of that federal money. Remember, we just signed on for this and get no money.
Yeah.
And so those dynamics are always in the room also when thinking about the limited resources that people have. And then it's also just, it's little things like, you know, who's going to copy the files and who's going to pay for it and those sorts of things. You know, the logistics sort of stuff of the meetings are also labor-intensive and resource-intensive at certain points. And so who you call upon to that, you have to be very sort of strategic about that in your decision-making.
And who did that? Is that the audit coordinator who would do that?
Yeah, we put almost all that work on the audit coordinator, mostly because they were being paid through the grant, and we found it as sort of central to their job. So, for example, there was one time where, I won't say which criminal justice agency, but essentially our audit coordinator spent a week over there using their copy machine.
Oh, wow.
You know, and sat in their office to redact the files over there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was the job of the audit coordinator.
Okay. Can me go back to this discussion of defensiveness and hurt feelings and probably some embarrassment. How did you handle that?
Well, I mean, I think the answer, of course, is it depends. You know, we had a situation in our community where the brother of one of our audit team members was arrested for sexual abuse of a child.
Uh-huh.
And so that was very present in the room, you know, in terms of nobody was talking about it, but it was a really big deal considering who this man was in our community.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the facilitation and who facilitates the meetings is really key. So, for example, if diplomacy is not your best skill and you're the audit coordinator, you thus should hand over the meetings to someone else because it's just not going to work. People will feel your defensiveness. People will feel your crassness, and it will affect everything that happens.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because people just aren't willing to come. And there is a level, and it's not something that people talk about a whole lot, but there's a level of burnout from a lot of people that do this work. And so the sort of the judgment that comes out, I think a lot of time is just that. I mean, I was recently talking with someone, and I introduced them to someone else who, before working for us, worked in a bank. And they said to her, "Oh, it must have been nice just to process money orders all day."
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so there's this comment to team members saying, you know, is this, I do more important work than you, is essentially what she was saying.
Mm.
You know, and you just do that. And I don't think that she meant to, you know, come off that way, but I think that there is a level of burnout that she's experiencing that we all experience at certain points, that if we don't identify, it can cause lots of problems.
Right, right. So so resources, finding the time, talking about systems rather than personal and the repercussions of that. Were there other challenges presented by small offices or small staff that Pam or Jen wanted to talk about?
Well, we certainly have the issue with the scheduling piece of it, but I think it's something that we experience on a daily basis anyway. So there's got to be a lot of flexibility with the audit team and the ability of people to come and go. And with ours, we often have people who have responsibilities in multiple counties. So if they have to leave, they're not coming back. And so it does create some challenges, but I think with the informal relationships and networking, that I'm having those conversations not just during the meetings or just during the scheduled time for doing interviews or case reviews, to keep people updated on what's going on is really important, and an important role for the coordinator. I think on the personal or the one-person offices, where when gaps are identified or problem areas are identified, I think there has to be, if there's not a strong level of trust among the audit team, I think that can cause some real barriers to finding solutions. And one of the things that we had to constantly remind ourselves at the local team level was that we are all a part of the problem, and we're all a part of the solution. And just because something happened that was not a good outcome by one agency, how are we all a part of that, and how are we all influenced by that? And I think it really helped us to keep our eye on the bigger picture, that we all are interconnected, and decisions and choices we make are largely because of information we're receiving or sharing. And if we didn't, if we do have bad practices, then we need to own it and change it, and we're all there to support each other in doing that. And also looking at how much of our local rules, policies, procedures are influenced or dictated by state and federal law as well as state-level policy. And we learned a lot about what we just assumed we were doing because we thought it was the right thing, how much of that was shaped by state-level policy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Jen, did you have something
else? Yeah, a couple things I wanted to say. One is that when we first started doing these audits, so it was 2000, we had a core team that we put together, and that team stayed strong for 4 audits. And so the first time we went through a lot of those, well, this is about your office, or you have the money, or you have those kinds of things happening. And then as we started going to more and more and more audits, we kind of got this idea that, you know, if we're not looking at your office right now, we will be. So tread carefully.
Yeah.
Be kind, because it will be you eventually. At least in our community, it will be you. And then we just really developed a great trust as a team through that. And having the amazing buy-in from leadership in our area really helped with the time management things. It's always going to be hard to get those meetings scheduled and to have the audit seen as valuable as the emergency work that people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a challenge. It's a challenge for the management and the leadership, and it's a challenge for the individual worker whose work doesn't go anywhere while they're gone for
those days.
We've tried many different kinds of techniques to go around that. You know, the short meetings every week, the short meetings every 2 days, the week-long pretend you're at a training and you leave your office and you don't go there.
Yeah.
And that is what we did for this last 2 audits, and it was very, very difficult to schedule it. But once it was done, we got everyone and booked a room in a hotel, a meeting room in a hotel, and had everyone go physically away from their offices. Because the other part of being in a small town is we were always meeting at someone's office.
Yes.
And that's really hard for them to stay present.
Mm-hmm. Going away in retreat centers and being out helps in so many different ways. Right, right, right.
Absolutely. And feeding people well.
Feeding people well. Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly. So there's relationship building within the audit process, but it seems to me in smaller communities too that, and it, when you have limited staff, if you have histories with them that might be negative, does that stop them from wanting to be on the team? I mean, do you have to overcome some kind of buy-in if there's, you know, something happened 15 years ago and people are still tense about it?
This is Pam Wiener. I mean, I think that's absolutely true. I think any time that we're doing our professional work in the community, we're always having to step back before we say something that could be hurtful or challenging, or as to how that's going to affect that particular player who is the only player for that particular agency who you have to deal with for the next 100 years and who you have to get good results with your clients. And I don't think that means that you don't do the good work and you make decisions that compromise victims or your agency, but you have to be very diplomatic in how you approach issues and what channels you go through to get those addressed. And I see that especially true when you're dealing with multiple counties, and that small communities take a lot of pride in their own community. They tend to be very conservative and oftentimes somewhat closed to outsiders and don't want outsiders telling them what to do.
Right.
And so it's so important to build those bridges with community leaders within each county who then take the lead in trying to implement policies, changes, conversations around gaps, who are well ingrained and trusted by community leaders.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and something that has come up on the variety of our calls is that if there is that resistance or people being fearful of who's participating and what the report's going to say, that sort of thing, that having Praxis get on the phone or in some cases even come to your community and talk to those folks helps with that buy-in, kind of helps explain the process maybe in a different kind of way that helps them see that this could be a positive thing or has been positive in other communities. So,
This is Melissa. I want to say a little bit about that only because I'm not going to name the Criminal Justice Agency. Only Praxis knows who this is in our community, but that we had such a challenge with one partner in particular that Praxis ended up having to take over the audit, essentially.
Oh.
And only just to, we got really stuck, our community did, when talking about the different roles of a victim witness coordinator and a domestic violence advocate.
Oh, yeah.
It, which is like a historical thing that happens across the country, right?
Right.
But there, it really, really became an issue.
Okay.
And so we had to just call in someone else because what happened is that, you know, debating about it essentially.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when you've been with each other for so long, it just, sometimes it just doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
And so we had to bring in some BWJP staff just to come in on a conference call, essentially, just to be sort of a facilitator / referee on the
right
issue.
Right.
And I'm proud to say that we knew we were right, and Praxis supported us. So. But,
well, it sounds like that is a common resource for people to really get, especially during that buy-in stage when there's kind of not sure what's going to happen and how it's going to happen. That calling upon Praxis is something that can be done. But well,
right.
Kind of watching the time here. But before we open up for questions, we've talked about some of the barriers and challenges of small staff, limited staff. What are the strengths? Could we run through some of the strengths and positive ways that those small offices have been helpful in a safety audit?
Well, it's easier to get things done.
There are currently 2 participants in your conference.
Thank you.
It's easy to get things done when it's a small community. I mean, that's the blessing of it all.
Uh-huh.
So you don't have to go through 5 layers of bureaucracy if you're going to change a form, for example.
Yeah.
So that's a blessing. Always then there's less people to communicate with about any changes that are going to occur.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, it's much easier in a rural community. Once you make the decision about you're going to change something, you don't have to tell many people about it.
And so, they're on the team, so they know. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's face-to-face contact about that it's going to change. So that's, I always think that's the best benefit about being in a rural community.
Yep. Other strengths?
This is Jennifer. I think that going along with that, it really makes the audit team members feel like what they're doing is going to have an impact when we are in a small town. And it helps us to know that this isn't something that's just going to get lost out there or that something that's going to be just drifting in the wind, that each of our audits has had something that happens or multiple things that happen that has affected them. And to, like we were saying earlier, you know, a lot of people don't know how one agency's decisions really impact 8 agencies down the line or that family 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. And within the audit team, that sense of accomplishment is really nice for us. And that's been a particularly good way to get people to be on the team as well, because they've seen how it's impacted other people.
Right. And it's obvious and it's right there and can be rewarded for that immediately. Yeah.
This is Pam with Legal Aid. And I think the accountability that each agency has when there's only one official heading up the agency, and it really comes down to their participation in the process. And when there is such small agencies, the agencies become very interdependent on each other, and together they can be far more successful in outcomes for victims and survivors than independently of each other. And so in terms of getting things done or getting a better idea of the big picture or being able to have those aha moments when it's just one person in each agency you're trying to convince as opposed to a whole team of judges or a whole team of prosecutors, I think brings about change much more quickly in small communities.
And invested. Yeah.
Yes.
Great. then the last issue that we wanted to talk about was close personal relationships. You know, in small communities, everybody literally knows everybody. Even in more populated communities, the criminal justice practitioners know each other, have had some relationships maybe through the CCR. And in some communities, there's very few boundaries between that personal and professional relationship. Pam, in Napoleon, Ohio, where the national audit was conducted, that's a county seat with about 14,000 people, and it seemed like the audit team all knew each other very well and had worked together in a variety of ways. Can you start our conversation with what challenges those personal relationships presented?
Well, I think one of the interesting pieces, at least in our rural communities, is that many people never leave their community, whether it be, you know, families or community leaders. And so many of the people who participated in our audit had been the head of their agencies for many, many, many years and have worked together for many, many years. And I think that one of the challenges that you get with that, it does definitely center around issues with confidentiality, and so we always have to keep ourselves in check with that. But I think one of the really exciting pieces of that is that you're always approaching issues as a multidisciplinary team, because there are so few resources and so few players that you're constantly engaging in conversations around what's working, what's not working, how do we increase resources, how do we help each other out. And I think another challenge in small communities, which I brought up earlier, is that they often tend to be very conservative, very closed to outsiders. And so how do you build on community strengths and reinforce the importance of the community values and the systems they've had in place, while at the same time identifying practices that don't work or changes that need to be made and get that buy-in? And what we found, because there is such a close personal relationship among judges and prosecutors, law enforcement, advocates, healthcare providers, all the different other system players, protective services, CSEA, that we're engaging in conversations around what's working and what's not, or where there's problems. So, for example, in our audit, we were taking a look at the custody issues and how they were resolved through the family court. And that came about because of the family court judge saying, what's going on? We're seeing so many protection orders being dropped. We're seeing so many victims going back to their abusers. You know, what can we do differently, or is there something that needs to be done differently so that we can better protect families? And so that got the door open for more conversation at looking at those issues, and then having Praxis and the Battered Women's Justice Project to fall back on as experts, national experts, not the community next door who doesn't know any more than the other community, or who's not going to tell the other community what to do. But we have these national experts who can help us to get some insight into what's going on. And that ultimately led to us participating in this audit. But then what was great is, because the judge was identifying the issue, and the judge having so much trust and respect in the community, she has good relationships with the community leaders, and then was able to invite them to become a part of the audit team, the local audit team. And that, not that people weren't already committed, but that just reinforced the importance of the issue and the importance of identifying gaps and finding solutions, because it came from the judge.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, did you have ideas about how personal relationships affected your audit?
Well, yeah, this is an interesting topic, honestly, because when one of my, well, I'll say we had a pretty big audit team at one point. Well, I guess I don't know. It seemed big to us, but at one point we had 12 members on our audit team,
mm-hmm.
and four of us were, like, best friends. And so we spent a lot of time together outside of work.
Yeah.
And so it was an interesting challenge in many ways. In part, especially when you go to write the report, and who's going to write the report and what you're going to say is a very, very delicate sort of thing. So, and it was always an interesting dynamic where, because we were such good friends outside of work, was that when we came to those meetings, and I always say when the bosses came in the room, you know, because my friends were the bosses of their organization, how they had to change who they were in part of their thinking. It became this institutional thinking. So it's very much a dynamic of that. And one of the things, though, that I think created the biggest gateway for us was when we did our focus groups with battered women about how the criminal justice system was helping them in their lives or hindering them in their lives. It was a very interesting thing because people, in essence, either want to dismiss it or they don't want to look at it, which I always think is very fascinating. And the other thing that's always sort of sometimes present in the room is that, of course, many of the people experience domestic violence themselves. And so when you have close relationships, people already know that, or people end up talking about it themselves. And so either of those things can be helpful or not. But, the close relationships was always a challenge within our community.
Well, and that idea that you were a friendship group comes up so many times in lots of different areas of our work and can sometimes be seen as kind of this camp or this clique or this group that's kind of either an in-crowd or really making decisions amongst themselves, and I'm an outsider or I'm an insider. Did that come up with this idea that you were friends?
Well, I think that it became problematic when, I'll just call her Jane, okay? So Jane is one of our friends, and so two of us, so the friends work in the advocacy organization, two of them work in the criminal justice system. And so I'll just say, Jane, who works in the criminal justice system, we're always trying to get her to push to say more, right, about what she thinks.
Yeah.
And she's saying, I can't because of the working environment I'm in. And it's not, I will pay for saying something like that. You don't understand that. Right? And so,
yeah,
it was more of that sort of dynamic that was happening and going on.
But this is Denise. What do you do about that, Melissa?
Well, I mean, in part, we had to, it's part of the audit process on understanding the conditions under which people work. And so what we did is we didn't put a whole lot of pressure on her because she wasn't a decision maker in the organization. So we spent more time with the decision makers of the organization. Because she was one of the people from their department who was on, at the table.
So there were others that could have said something, yeah.
Right.
And that's one of the roles I think the audit coordinator can play, too, is if the audit coordinator knows that there are issues that need to be discussed, but somebody is not feeling safe bringing it forward, that either the audit coordinator or the audit coordinator brings it to a partner who can bring it up so the issue does get discussed, but it's not identified with a person who doesn't feel safe bringing it up. And if you've got a national team that's a part of the process, too, then that could be something that could be brought through the national folks.
Right, and that's kind of, Praxis ended up being quite involved in one of our audits that we did.
So as outsiders, they can even, you know, this is something that we see in common, or this is something that's come up in other audits. Yeah.
Well, essentially what happened, because you have this personal relationships, here's what ends up happening. I would go to the meeting and say something, and they would reject it. Praxis would come in and say the same exact thing, and they would accept it.
That sounds so familiar.
Right. I mean, and I do work with Praxis. So, I mean, I always, when I talk with, I do work with Praxis and with rural grantees. And I, almost every time I do a site visit, they say, well, you know, of course, that we've said that same exact thing.
Yes.
And they didn't hear it. And I said, I know.
I know.
Part of this work.
Yes, 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 always.
Someone with a different level of credibility has to come in.
So it's, I mean, this is a wonderful example of the complexity of these personal relationships, but I'm wondering, too, and Jen, you might be able to speak to this, how it is when you have your friends and maybe even a tight friendship or people that you've worked with and respect, how do you critique them? How do you honestly talk about a case or gaps without kind of building up that defensiveness or having that effective friendship too? Is that a problem?
It can be. I think that in my role as the audit coordinator, it's about helping people reframe it to always take it out of the personal and say, okay, so what is guiding you to make that decision? How is that happening? Or where do you get this information? What information do you have to make those decisions? And really leading it away from, well, you just don't like him, so you're making this decision or things like that. You know, it's a business from an audit coordinator standpoint. And, you know, my audits are interesting in that my mother has been on all 7 of our audits.
Oh. Well, that's interesting.
Because we, you know, a lot of fields have parents and children that work in the same field.
Sure.
And social services, obviously one of them. And it's been an interesting thing. We've been working collaterally in the community for 20 years, and you know, we don't work together, but we both have worked in the domestic violence field. And it's been an interesting thing because in terms of critiquing, you know, when we did the advocacy audit or when we're doing child welfare audit, which all the domestic violence, she's a domestic violence advocacy program manager, my mother is. And it's been an interesting thing to have to critique her agency's decision-making processes or to ask questions that are difficult of her and the patients. And I would say at the beginning, I think the audit team wasn't sure how I would handle that and how she would handle that.
Sure.
And we really modeled professionalism and modeled that I'm going to take the same level of investigation with her as I would with anyone else and treat her with the same respect I would anyone else. And then when they watched that happen over and over and over again, then the issues became, you know, it became really clear to people that it could happen. And then I think people felt less threatened within themselves because I also had my best friend on 2 audit teams and then 2 of the team members on several of them were partners. And you know, it's been a community. Right. So it's just about modeling and keeping coming back to it and being, for me as an audit coordinator, being available for people to talk to between the audit meetings and to say, oh, I really had trouble reading this because she's my sister-in-law.
Right.
She's my daughter-in-law. What do I do? And it's been interesting. Also, the other relationship piece that I wanted to touch on really quick is that we've also had supervisors and their staff on the same audit team.
Oh, okay.
And that's a challenge as well because the newer staff sometimes have these incredible insights that people who've been doing it for, you know, 20 years don't necessarily have at the same flow.
Right.
Have the same insights. And so to have the safety to be able to say what they really think and ask questions that challenge what's been, you know, the status quo or how things happen, to really facilitate that process was fascinating and engaging and could be challenging and really to work with people who were the supervisors outside of it and say, okay, so here's the audit team and here's the kinds of things you're going to be you know, expected to be able to respond to and to not take that back into the workplace and say, you questioned me in front of a group of people about this. Now you have a penalty.
Right.
But to really, from the highest level of management all the way through to really make sure that was a safe process.
Well, and to see that as exciting rather than fear.
Well, it can be, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so there's certainly a lot of relationships that are personal and professional. Thank you for your comments about how audit coordinators can handle that. And so what are some of the strengths in communities of those personal relationships?
I think that for us, sometimes, you know, we didn't have to mince words. We didn't have to beat around the bush. We could just say, hey, here's what I really think. I know you as a person. I know that we have these things in common. I can just say what I really think without fear of anything. And then again, just I think it made the team and made a group of people really strong together and have an allegiance to each other that goes well beyond the audit team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it impacts our community on a daily basis that we have these great connections and we have the support from upper level management that says, yes, you can talk to those people in agencies where we didn't used to talk or share information or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's really great.
And to be on the same audit team for multiple audits then. Yeah.
Yes, people want to be on the audit team. People are, sign me up for the next one. Don't lose my spot. They want to be there.
Oh, it's a fantasy come true. There you go.
Any other strengths
that you wanted to mention?
Well, this is Pam. I know for us it allowed us to make changes very quickly. I mean, when we identified a gap, it was like, oh, we've got to do something about that now. We can't wait until the report comes out. And so you don't have to jump a bunch of hoops or formalities, but you can make changes on those things that you can do at a local level. And it really creates a bond to know that you identified a problem, addressed it, and it really is bringing about community change.
Yes.
This is Melissa, and what I would say is that for us, it just becomes sort of a unity of being proud, and a community of being proud, you know, in the good culture of northern Minnesota. When you're proud and have a report done, you go and have a little drink afterwards.
Right.
You know, I mean that in just like a metaphorical way, but it's that sort of thing that happens. And you know, and they like to know, like, for example, like, I'll tell them all, you know, that I was on this call. They're like, you know, they like that. That it's a, that all those hours of redacting and all those hours of meeting that other communities will hear about it. And they've been on, they've been a part of the Safety and Accountability Audit Institute before.
Wow.
And so the criminal justice people have, and so that's a great benefit to them, just to talk about what it meant for them. And I just also want to go back to the thing about somebody, I forget which one of you had mentioned it, but about, we said, just be careful, it's going to be your turn soon. That's also the positive about having personal relationships, is because you can say that in a sort of fun way. Just wait until we do the prosecution audit.
Yes.
Just wait for that, because, you know, sort of this, you know, funny thing of paybacks, right? But there's a jovial sort of attitude too about it, that, you know, some things aren't that serious, you know, in terms of knocking down others. It doesn't get taken in that way.
Well, it strengthens that professional relationship and strengthens those friendships too. It lets you know different sides of people when you spend that many hours together.
Right.
In any way, it's got to help. But this is wonderful. A lot of information and some really good advice and really good sense of how audit coordinators can step forward and maximize those strengths and handle those challenges. We just have a couple minutes left. If anyone has any questions, now is the time.
Okay, yes, we do now have a guest in the queue, and that comes from the Hope Injustice Project. Your line is now open.
Who is this, please?
That is Francine. I don't actually have a question. I just wanted to say that, and I want you to know that I've been listening really attentively and enjoy listening to your own dialogue around this. It's been very helpful and instructive to me.
Oh, good, good.
Thank you. It's nice to know that we're not talking in a black hole.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Well, we covered a lot of territory, and some of these pieces you can be preparing for as you set up your first audit, and some of them, I love what someone said about this being a process, and you don't ever let some of these things off the table. They will keep coming back in new ways, taking new forms, and the exciting piece is having a group that really does problem solving in that forum and then can take that forward. So really do thank all of you and thank our guests for participating and sharing a lot of experience here. So it's very impressive. So Denise, did you want to talk about the next call?
Well, I just wanted to kind of wrap up by also offering my thanks to Melissa, Pam, and Jen for sharing your wealth of information and experience with us. And I should also tell you that contrary to what you might have heard, if you're out there feeling like it was you and one other person on the phone, we just had a little glitch in kind of our audio conference service here. And so it wasn't just you and one other person. We've had a number of callers on here, and I'm really glad that people were able to be on the call today and kind of learn a little bit about sort of what it's actually like to tackle an audit project in a small rural community. And want to remind people that if you are conducting audits or interested in exploring an audit, you can certainly contact me at Praxis for any kind of technical assistance that you need on your audit project. Our next call is scheduled for a week from today, next Wednesday, November 17th at 2 p.m. Central. And the topic of our call next Wednesday is conducting audit projects that involve multiple agencies or multiple jurisdictions, with some focus on how to define the scope of your audit, how to develop your audit question to kind of help you focus your efforts in the best way possible that fits for your community. So with that, I want to thank everyone again for participating in the call. Good day to all, and hope to talk with some of you next week. Bye.